Gary Noll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. You are listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Serious subjects, important guest, deeper insights. Today, understanding the new world order, its economic regime, and global governance. Our panel today will begin with Professor Roderick Tremblay. He is a prominent economist who is now a professor emeritus at the University of Montreal. In the late 1970s, he served as the Minister of Industry and Commerce in Quebec. Dr. Tremblay is also the president of the North American Economics and Finance Association and president of the Canadian Economic Society. He has authored over 25 books on economics, finance, and a variety of global ethical and political issues. His blog on geopolitics is read throughout the world and translated into 8 languages. His most recent book, The Code of Global Ethics, 10 Humanist Principles, addresses the urgent need for a new sense of morals in the face of immense international and global challenges. The book is The Code for Global Ethics, the website and blog, thenewamericanempire.com. Later in the program, he will be joined by Professor Michael Chofshedowski. He is a professor emeritus at the University of Ottawa in Ontario, and he's been an economic advisor to many developing countries. He is the founder of the Center for Research on Globalization at the University of Montreal and founding editor of Global Research. He is one of the world's leading visionaries in economic trends associated with free market globalization, having identified over 15 years ago many of the problems in global neoliberal economics that are now frequent in our headlines: austerity, economic shock therapy, the association between rising poverty, the pillaging of developing nations due to the structural adjustment policies of the U.S. led by the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, and the criminalization of our banking system. He has written several books, most notably The Globalization of Poverty, as well as The New World Order, and Towards an World War III Scenario, The Dangers of Nuclear War. His website is globalresearch.com. First, welcome to our program. Nice to have you with us today.
Good evening, Mr. Noll. How are you?
Excellent. Now, as people who may not be familiar with this program are tuning in for the first time, unlike most radio programs, I believe that context is essential. Therefore, that the guests should not be rushed. They should have an uninterrupted opportunity to share their points of view, give examples, and so we have a better understanding of what they're trying to say rather than little tiny news bites. So you'll hear that my questions are few, longer, but then my guests have a great deal of time to answer this. We're also video streaming. I'm back for our first program in 10 weeks in our studios in New York. For the Progressive Commentary Hour, you can watch this program by going to progressiveradionetwork.com or GaryNoll.com. Now, we're going to begin with you, Professor Tremblay.
Yes.
We hear the term New World Order, and generally one of two things comes to mind. First, we ask, is this a would-be global government that supersedes national governments and national sovereignty? Beliefs in who would run this global government vary: the UN, the American Empire, a cartel, mega banks, etc. And the second view is that it is run by a collection of groups such as the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Roundtable groups, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the Bilderberg Group, Wall Street, and all this with the blessings of the highest members of the U.S. government. In either case, there is a belief that there is a planned and intentional strategy to conspire against national governments, in cahoots with some governments from the developed world, such as the U.S. and Britain, to create a new world order. And this is heavily promoted on the Internet. There are hundreds of documentaries and commentaries and articles. They try to bring in the Illuminati. They try to bring in the Queen of England. They try to make a strong case that this is the reality. When I've asked for hard data, hard proof, I find bits and pieces, not a whole. Instead, I would propose that we examine a third scenario, and that although these groups and financial corporations are involved in the emergence of a new world order, there is no clear definition of what that should be, nor is there a definitive plan other than it being the natural emergence of greed, power, and control, a disregard of human rights, and caring for the poorest, the poor, and the freedoms of human beings. And when those in power, political and economic, ignore those values, then it is natural in an evolutionary way that when fear trumps human rights and dignity is trumped, we find a repressive system of governance and control coming into being. So I would like to begin with your comments first on whether or not such an order actually exists. And then, second, what defines a new world order today, and what do you believe are the main factors that are giving rise to that within the dominant paradigm of the globalization of free market neoliberal economic policies? Take your time. The forum is yours.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Nall. When people refer to the new world order, they refer to two basic trends in politics and in economics over the last 30, 35 years. And in politics, it means that the old world order was created around the United Nations, and it was based on nation states. Nation states were supposed to be independent entities, and their economies were supposed to be organized in a way to promote the interests of their citizens. With the New World Order, you witness the demise of the nation state. The nation state and their governments are losing power and instruments to intervene in their own political sphere, but also in their own economy. You see that in Europe with the creation of the European Union, the 27 countries of the European Union, and you have also the 17 countries of the Eurozone. And the countries, Germany, France, Italy, Ireland, and so on, have governments who are which are unable to face to crisis that arise, and the people are becoming the more and more distressed because they know that their politicians, their elected politicians, do not have the tools to correct an economic situation that is known to create unemployment and a lower standard of living. And even somebody in Europe are talking about the need maybe in a few years to have revolutionary changes to reverse that trend. So the New World Order can be seen as excessive globalization that has taken place very quickly over the period of three or decades, and are now at a dead end because the crises that are multiplying means that nobody is in charge and nobody can correct a situation. And you have a good example today when a small country like Cyprus in the middle of the Mediterranean will have an impact. Something happening in that country has an impact worldwide. So this is very a very unstable situation, both politically and economically. As far as politics is concerned, the United States, because the United States was in charge of building the old world order, because the United States was the main force behind the creation of the United Nations after the demise of the League of Nations, and this was created in San Francisco in 1945. But after 1980s, the United States changed course. The United States now is has been promoting the demise of the United Nations and the demise of international law, traditional international law, and has propose, instead of imposing through its huge military might a sort of a Pax Americana in the world, using all type of new technology electronically, and you have the wars with drone, and we are talking of robotic armies being prepared for the future. It goes beyond fiction. And the war of Iraq on March 20th, 2003, marked another step toward that Pax Americana, when the Bush-Cheney government decided to go against the wishes of the Security Council of the United Nations. That was the first time that this has happened, and launch a war which was not sanctioned by the United Nations against Iraq. And this month marks the 10th anniversary of that war. So politically, we seem to move to a world order where a few big, strong countries dictate their policies to other smaller countries. That trend is going fast in that direction. And the world for that is we are building empires. The imperial approach to organization of society is coming back. Mind you, we are going back to the 19th century in a sense, because during the 19th century, this was the British Empire which was playing that role. And in this 21st century, it looks like it will be the American Empire. As far as the economy is concerned, we are also going back to the 19th century. That model of economic of excessive globalization, we had that in the later part of the 19th century, when we had the gold standard as the world monetary system. Under that system, of course, countries could not do very much. No governments could interfere in the company in their economies. That was run by international bankers and international large corporations. The end result was a series of crises. There were many recurring crises in 1870, in 1896, in 1907, and so on. These were financial crises mainly at the beginning, but they turned out to be also economic crises with high unemployment, a very stagnant standard of living for most people except for the very rich. Here in the United States, they used to call them robber barons. And we are going back to that system now. And we see the same results. It means there are more and more stagnation in the real income of the middle class. There is very difficult, serious unemployment in some countries like Spain. It's above 25%, and if you count only the unemployment of the youth, it's more closer to 50%. And wealth and power tends then to be concentrated in the hands of a fraction of the population, the famous 1%. And because of this inequalities, these inequalities, an entire economy becomes more stagnant. There is income stagnation for most of the people. And we enter a period of where the standard of living of the majority of the people is not increasing. It's only the standard of living of a very fraction of the population. So my idea is that this excessive globalization and economically, and this excessive concentration of power in the hands of a few government officials politically, means that this is untenable. I don't think that an educated populations now will accept that, especially with the information that exists today, will tolerate that for many years. What I mean is that it will probably lead to revolutions. Where it will start, I don't know. But this is not a model that can be sustainable.
I appreciate those insights. We're going to break down some of what you just suggested and be more specific. For example, over the weekend, the government of Cyprus decided, without informing the public, that it was going to charge a one-time tax ranging from 5.8% for those under $100,000 to 9.8%, nearly 10% for those over $100,000. And it was going to be taken directly out of their bank account. And they had a bank holiday then and over the weekend and today and probably tomorrow. And this was to go towards paying off their debts. And they still needed an additional $5 billion. What the people are angry about is that this was precedent setting. And many other countries like Slovakia, for example, and Greece said, well, if they can do it, take money out of someone's personal savings account, and maybe the person has no other resources except what's in that account, and they didn't ask me, they simply confiscated my money. That is going to cause reverberations. Now, it wouldn't cause a lot of problems in the United States, because you could do almost anything in the United States today, and we are, and get away with it, because we are complacent. With the exception of the true progressives and independents, the corporate Democrats and the corporate liberals, the corporate conservatives and the corporate Republicans together are the problem. They offer absolutely no solution, but they are the ones who have all the power. They own the media, they control Congress, or they control ALEC and other groups and lobbyists that control Congress. So they make sure that whatever their needs are met. The average person is watching television, being distracted, and is not out there engaged in protests, letter writing, voting independent, being healthy, caring for their environment. They're virtually asleep. But not in Europe, not in the Middle East, not elsewhere. So here is my issue. As an economist, as one of the world's leading thinkers in economic systems, could you explain to this audience how what happened today happened in Greece? The Greek are fighting back. But it wasn't money that was taken to pay the bills of the country. It was taken, as it was in Greece with the enormous financial bailout, to pay back the very banks and lending institutions and bondholders who helped negotiate them into this crisis to begin with. And once the people understand that you're paying back through your austerity, lower pensions, lower living wage, evisceration of your health benefits, food subsidies, petrol subsidies, the privatization of your resources like electric, water, transportation, and your national assets being stripped off and sold to the very people, the very consortiums, bank, hedge funds, large groups of financial investors who see you as an enormous asset because they can bankrupt you. They can then enforce austerity programs, and then when you have nothing more you can give, they say, now sell us your assets. We want your islands. We want your monuments. We'll turn them into hotels. We want you not to be able to walk down a street. You have to pay a toll. We want no more free water coming out of a tap. You will pay for that water. You're not going to be able to walk into a hospital and get health care. You'll pay for it. You're going to pay for everything. And if you can't pay for it, your government will pay for it, and they'll take more of your money to do it. So we're not even aware in the United States, we're clueless in the United States, that the money that is called the debt was not used for infrastructure, for people's quality of life, to help the people create jobs or build factories or improve the standard of living. To the contrary, it does just the opposite, and that is part of the corporate Obama, Clinton, neoliberal globalization concept. Your thoughts on that, please, and challenge me where I am in error.
Well, these things are very complex, and you set it up very clearly. In the case of Cyprus, even if it is a very small economy, and you know Cyprus is politically half Turkish and half Greek because of historical reason, it's part of the Eurozone, one of the 17 countries in Europe, and uses the Euro. It has become over the years a tax haven for many people, mainly Russians, who have deposited a lot of money through that back door to Europe, in a sense, in Cyprus banks. Now these banks are in very dire difficulties, and the European Central Bank, which is a bit like the Fed here, sort of a banking cartel of European banks, but very dominated by the richest country and the more stable
Germany.
Economy in Europe, the Germany, advanced some money to save these banks, but said, especially because of the German Chancellor, Madame Merkel, said, well, you're going to the told the Cyprus government, you're going to tax the savings of these foreigners, but of course some are Cyprus citizens also, and you will tax, as you mentioned, above 100,000 euro, 10% and less for smaller accounts. This, of course, is a good recipe to have a run on a bank. As soon as people are afraid of losing their deposit in a bank, there's a run to withdraw the money, and this time it's a run on the ATM because the banks have been closed until the government of Cyprus has an opportunity to vote on that bailout program that the ECB is imposing on them. Therefore, when they open the bank, I don't know, in a few days, there will be a lot of money going out of Cyprus. And this is very counterproductive because one of the main innovation that was has been done since the 1930s in our countries has been to guarantee for $100,000 or less the deposits to a fund which is paid by banks. But I know we know that the depositors and the savers pay for that. And this, even if bank becomes insolvent, people don't rush to withdraw the money. And as we had in the past, banking panic because we didn't have that protection. So in Europe, this sort of a mistake that they did doing that, and I don't know how they're going to correct that, but that was a mistake. But the mistake. The main reason, though, they did that because they thought that the Germans didn't want to bail out the Russians who had put their money in Cyprus in this tax haven. The fundamental problem, though, in Europe, in many countries, is because within the, especially the Eurozone, because the EU with 27 countries, it's mainly an economic zone, it's not a monetary zone. The 17 countries of the Eurozone have different level of productivities. For example, the Greek would be as productive as the Germans, but they have the same currency and the same price level. Now, what Chancellor Merkel just said, as a matter of fact, yesterday, they had to lower these countries, which are non-competitive, have to lower their wages and their prices in order to compete. This is what we can call a forced devaluation. But since they don't have a currency of their own, they cannot devalue anymore. This is true for the French, who don't have the franc, the Italians don't have the lira, and the Greeks don't have the drachma. So they cannot devalue. So we are back to the gold standard of 1870 at the end of the 19th century, when nobody could really devalue. The only way you could devalue in real term was to lower your wages and lower your prices and have austerity. Have unemployment, have a decline in production. This is a very inefficient way of building the competitiveness of an economy because socially it becomes very difficult and politically nearly impossible to impose this type of austerity program.
Let me add a suggestion and then I'd like your response on it. Let's just be very practical for a moment. Greece is one of the most beautiful places on earth, as is Cyprus and other countries in the area. If you're going to help a country to become financially stable, you look at what they're most likely to be able to produce. If it's tourism, then you put together tiny interest loans, micro loans, and then you allow the person to develop orchards. You allow them to open up different hotels. You have a public works project to make your roads better, to make the ocean cleaner, to get the refuse from going directly into the Mediterranean, which frequently it does. You end up expanding the historical parts of the city, so they're more interesting to visit as a tourist, because where do we go when we go to Rome or when we go to France? We want to see the Eiffel Tower. We want to go to the old villages. So you put your money where you improve these, because everything in life that we own requires servicing and maintenance. So then you start looking at what kind of jobs can they do. Well, in Portugal, it's making shoes. So how can you make shoes better without automation, where you actually get back to handcrafting and wildcrafting? People give the average person a chance to have something that's handmade versus machine-made. More often than not, they'll want the handmade. And give the person a chance to buy something that's locally grown, organically versus GM, genetically engineered grown, 1,000 miles away. They want the locally grown. So by reaffirming the standard of helping people at the grassroots level, encouraging their development, getting more businesses, expanding the business they have, ensuring a better standard of living, having universal health care, promoting healthier living, and then making sure that the rich don't get away without paying taxes, which was a principal problem in both Cyprus and certainly in Greece, where the rich just regularly omitted paying any taxes because they had a lot of political control. Now then what you do is, if you have banks that are failing because they got caught up in greed and many loans and had their fractional reserves were extended to 100 to 1, they had $1 and they loaned out 100, fine, take them through a structured bankruptcy and let the people who were investors in the bank or those that were the ones who were carrying the profit load, let them take the loss. And if need be, nationalize the bank so you have a people's bank, much like we have in Montana and some other states, and or a credit union, so the people are directly involved in their own banking system. Now then, what do we do? Do we do that? That makes sense. That people put people to work, make beautiful environment, lower crime, beautiful infrastructure. No, we do just the opposite. Now, what is the prescription? Let's just take Greece for example. A, we have the highest flow of capital going out of Greece in the last 3 years per population of any country in Europe. Why? Because the wealthy people are not going to pay the taxes. They're going to expatriate themselves to another country, or they're going to hide their assets. The government then brings down the pension. So if you were making $1,200 a month, an average pension in Greece, actual figure, now you're making $900. Well, you're just barely making ends meet. As long as there wasn't more than like 3% inflation standard at $1,200, but at $900, now inflation comes. You want food, you pay more for it. Everything costs more, but you can't afford all this. So now what we have is we have people who no longer have a quality of life, no longer can maintain a standard of living, and especially the older people. Also, we have an enormous amount of young people who can't find jobs. So then the places that you can work, they start reducing wages. Now we reduce the living wage and the minimum wage, and then we start cutting back services. Why pick up the people's garbage 4 days a week? Pick it up once. Why deliver the mail every day? Deliver it once a week. And all, while we're at it, why should these people be getting away by paying so little on electricity? Charge them more. So now the people in Greece are staggering under austerity. The crime is endemic. Everywhere you go in Greece, you're going to be facing the potential for being robbed or mugged. And the Greeks themselves are fearful of going out because of the randomness of the violence. It used to be in poorer neighborhoods. Now it's in all neighborhoods. So what you have is, how many people want to go to Greece? Today, very few, unless it's one of the islands that has not yet been impacted. you're just not finding people who want to go to Greece. That'd be like going to Cairo last year in the middle of the Spring Revolution. It's not going to happen. And nobody goes to Zimbabwe on a safari because there's a high probability you're not coming home. So you have to understand the reality. If you're the average person, everything they're doing with structural adjustments that they did for decades in Africa and around the world, loading up countries with debt when they couldn't pay the debt and they knew they couldn't, then they take their assets and create perpetual debt peonage. So now in the very countries where you want to go, the infrastructure is falling apart. There's no money. People are unemployed. The restaurants are closing. The resorts are closing. Factories are closing. So now what do? They double down, go deeper. Cut more, then no one's saying, well, hold on a second. Why are we doing all this? What is the object lesson here? Are you trying to see how much a human being can suffer before they finally die? How much austerity are we supposed to go through? We can't maintain our water systems, our air systems. We can't maintain our hospitals, our schools are closing. Where are we supposed to be 2 years from now? We're only going to be further broke, and then you're going to say, okay, all the more reason to give the fat bankers, the Wall Street titans, even more money, and if you can't do that, then we're going to take your assets. We'll own Mount Olympus. We'll own the great islands. So I see that everything that's being done right now is wrong. A short answer, because my next guest is on the phone. We're going to go to him. I'd like your thoughts on what we have done, and the American press has been abiding by this. The government has been abiding by it. Obama and the corporate Democrats and corporate liberals are all applauding structural adjustment, applauding these draconian rules because their banks are being paid. The financial firms and bondholders are being paid, and they don't give a damn about the average persons. Now, that's my personal and subjective opinion. I'd like to have a short answer from you on yours.
Well, a few years ago, I wrote an article called Saving the Banks and Killing the Economy. And the spiral downwards that you are describing is really what's happening. It destroyed these countries, and it goes down and down and down. And you take the example of two other countries that didn't follow that path, didn't follow that model, Iceland and Argentina, and they are rebounding economically. But they were in the same vice. They were pressure and pressure until the last drop of blood. But their economy will have been destroyed completely if they had not got out of the system. Let the banks fail and set up a new monetary system. In Argentina, they went back to the peso, and unemployment is much lower than it used to be when they had the U.S. dollar. They had adopted the U.S. dollar a bit like the Greeks have adopted the German mark, because the euro is really the German mark disguised, and this is too strong a currency for these very small and less productive economies.
I appreciate your input. You're listening to Professor Rodrigue Tremblay, professor emeritus at the University of Montreal and a leading economist, an author of many books, including The Code of Global Ethics. Now we're joined by Professor Michel Chafchidowski. He is a professor emeritus at the University of Ottawa in Ontario, and he is a leading theoretician. He is a challenger of global neoliberal economics and market globalization, and he is the author of many works, including The Globalization of Poverty, as well as The New World Order. Nice to have you with us today.
Yes, good evening. Delighted to be on the program.
I'm very concerned that the average American, if you mention structural adjustment and what it means and where the money went and what has to happen to pay it back and what suffering the people had to go through, the average American is simply unaware. Would you bring us up on what has happened in the last 40 years with structural adjustment from the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, all supported by every single administration in the United States?
Well, let me maybe twist it upside down, because what is happening today in the United States with the fiscal cliff and the austerity measures is an extension of what was applied, but much more devastating, on developing countries starting in the early 80s, but in fact even earlier for some countries. There's a consistency in the neoliberal agenda, and what that neoliberal agenda does through financial manipulation, it ultimately undermines the real economy through debt conditionalities. That's the word used by the International Monetary Fund to enforce its so-called structural adjustment program. And what the IMF would do, starting in the early 80s, would be go into a country which had a balance of payments deficit or crisis, demand, first of all, an immediate devaluation of the currency. That was never part of the actual agreement with the IMF, but it was de facto. Freeze the wages, open up the economy to free trade, hike up the interest rates, which would literally wipe credit to the real economy off the map, and impoverish the population. And this was also a mechanism which allowed the creditors, the external creditors, to take over the real economy. In other words, to take over the major state enterprises, the resource companies, and ultimately, it was in effect, it was a process of recolonization. But what was absolutely devastating was the impact on people's standard of living. I think that this model of intervention, which now culminates with the experience of the developed countries, Greece, Portugal, Spain, Italy, but also the United States of America and the United Kingdom. It started in the early 80s, and it was conducive to the destabilization of entire national economies, and it impoverished the population to such an extent. I started working on the structural adjustment programs in the early 80s. In fact, I would say I started even earlier than that, because I was in Chile at the height of the September 11, 1973 coup d'etat, where the military came to power. But with the military came the so-called Chicago Boys, who took over the reins of economic policy, and from one day to the next, the price of bread went from 11 to 40. There was a fourfold increase in the price of bread, and basic essentials, runaway inflation, freeze of wages, and in a matter of months, the population was impoverished. In Peru, in 1990, 91, and this is very hard even to conceptualize, the price of gasoline went up 30 times overnight. Literally on the orders of the IMF, literally paralyzing the economy. Transportation was collapsed. People's earnings were not even sufficient to buy basic food staples. What I'm suggesting here is that structural adjustment was a mechanism of manipulation, of economic manipulation, devastating, ordering the closing down of health centers and schools, for instance, putting a ceiling on spending in the social sectors, exactly what the Obama administration is doing now. Now, it's not quite the same as in a third world country, but in effect, what we are now experiencing in Western countries is the third worldization. It's a process whereby developed countries with advanced welfare state social programs, particularly in Western Europe, are being impoverished and subjected to the same economic medicine which was applied 30 years ago to the developing countries, Asia, Latin America, and sub-Saharan Africa.
I appreciate those insights. I'm going to bring us back to a central theme of the program, and that is understanding the so-called New World Order and the economic regime and global governance, whether it's planned or whether it's simply something that occurs because such a few corporations and entities under about 2,000 have such unbridled power that they can demand what they want to demand. Now, for you, I'm going to ask you to address this, if you would, the relationship between economic shock therapy as a means of depleting nations and populations in order to serve the financial interests of those in power. And also, I'm very concerned in the United States that we have all of these ever-increasing draconian measures, the National Defense Authorization Act, the Patriot Act II, and virtually no rule of law whatsoever. Now, that is the front story. The back story is, for those who want to know, have there been people who believe there should be a world governance? George Bush, the first, in a speech on September 11th, 1990, quote, out of these troubled times, our fifth objective, a new world order, can emerge. 1995, National Security Advisor at the time, Brzezinski, quote, the new world order will emerge step by step, stone by stone. Arthur Schlesinger, writing in a 1995 Foreign Affairs, that's the publication of the Council on Foreign Relations, quote, we're not going to achieve a new world order without paying for it in blood as well as money and words. Henry Kissinger, stating on the day of Obama's inauguration, quote, the alternative to a new international order is chaos. Then, of course, the famous statement that I've seen the video of in his autobiography, quote, some even believe we are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure. One world, if you will. If that is the charge, I stand guilty and I am proud of it, end quote. One of the most powerful people in the world historically, and that is David Rockefeller, who's still alive and founded the Council on Foreign Relations.
Yeah.
So there are individuals who've gone public with their interest in a new world order and a global superpower structure. Take us through step by step what you see the issues as being.
Well, first of all, that statement by George Herbert Walker Bush, that was a historical address to a session of the U.S. Congress and the Senate in September 1990, which you quoted, I don't think he wrote that speech. It might well have emanated from David Rockefeller. For what, you know, it's clear that that was a very important watershed, the early 90s. Why? It was the end of the Cold War. Russia was not an obstacle at the geopolitical level. It was just prior to the, it was after the invasion of Kuwait by Iraq, which in effect, as we know, was got the green light from the United States through the U.S. ambassador to Baghdad at the time. And then, it was used to initiate the Gulf War as a pretext. But that period is very crucial because it's a new world order emerging from the rubble of the Berlin Wall. It is the demise of the Soviet Union as a countervailing power, and it certainly was not opening the door to peaceful international cooperation as we see it today. But at the same time, it means that the corporate interests, banks, multinational corporations behind this agenda have the ability to use various mechanisms to extend their empire, both in terms of military means. Okay, we can see that was a period that. So-called post-Cold War period was a period of relentless wars, starting with Iraq and subsequently Afghanistan, and then Iraq again, and various interventions and regime changes. So that I started my career as an economist. I lived through two major military coups. One was Chile in 1973. One was Argentina in 76. I worked in Venezuela in the mid-70s at the height of the oil crisis. And then in the 80s, I went to China. But the thing is that all those regime changes, whether they came through violent means, through the instatement of a military dictator, as in Chile and Argentina. In Argentina, supported by the Catholic Church. That's another subject in its own right, including the Pope that has recently been instated in the Vatican, who's Argentinian and who supported the military at the time. But I think all those mechanisms, regime change, war, they are parallel mechanisms to the neoliberal policy agenda. You need to implement parallel institutional changes to enforce the structural adjustment program. You can't impose it on countries which have a sovereign democratic government. So you either need a military dictatorship or you need some kind of proxy regime which will accept the structural adjustment program. Oh, incidentally, that was also a watershed year as far as Egypt is concerned, because in 1991, at the height of the Gulf crisis, the IMF came in and imposed the most devastating macroeconomic reforms. I happened to be in Egypt at the Ministry of Finance at that very moment when those reforms were implemented. So that essentially what I'm suggesting is that war and globalization go hand in hand. Macroeconomic reform is supported by a whole series of other interventions, covert operations, military, theater wars. There's a doctrine in the Pentagon, which is the doctrine of the long war, the military roadmap, as described by Wesley Clark, when he said, you know, there's so and so many countries on the roadmap to establishing U.S. hegemony. If we look at the project for the new American century, we also have this doctrine whereby the United States would be waging consecutively, in fact, simultaneously, large-scale theater wars, military interventions, as well as regime change. All of this was defined in the early 90s, and what we've witnessed particularly in the post 9/11 period, are military interventions and regime change and the globalization of war, in a sense. And to get back to the New World Order from a corporate point of view, who are the main actors, or which are the main entities in this corporate world? I would say, first of all, there's Wall Street and big banking, too big to fail, too big to jail. Okay, there's the corrupt financial system. Then you have the oil companies, the oil and energy companies, and they're not strictly limited to oil and gas. They extend to other areas of energy. Then you have the military, so-called military industrial complex, to use the words of President Eisenhower, which are the big defense contractors, the Anglo-American defense contractors, because British Aerospace Systems now is pretty much part of the U.S. Landscape as far as Department of Defense procurement contracts. Then you have the biotech conglomerates, the companies that produce genetically manipulated, modified seeds. They control the agricultural cycle. They control the pharmaceutical companies. They also are producers of chemical weapons and biological weapons, so they overlap with the military-industrial complex. You have the mercenary companies as well, and security companies, which are an appendage of the defense contractors. Lest we forget, there's also, of course, the global media conglomerates, which are there to create the underpinnings, the propaganda underpinnings for this system to function. You need to mislead people. You need to fabricate facts, turn realities upside down to the extent that people will support the New World Order in a way which is where they'll say, oh, yes, we need to kill people to ensure democracy. And that is pretty much the language which has been used by the Obama administration when they provide legitimacy to targeted assassinations, not to mention assassinations of foreign leaders that you don't like, and so on. So that, I think that's the background. We're at a very dangerous crossroads in world history. We're looking at very complex weapon systems. Non-conventional warfare is the mainstay, but it's not limited to drone warfare. There are various very sophisticated weapons which we barely discuss, such as environmental modification techniques, the weather warfare. Of course, the nuclear warfare is still on the books. And contrary to the situation which prevailed during the Cold War era, nuclear weapons are now, in effect, they've been recategorized as harmless to surrounding civilian population. They're not considered as dangerous to civilians, and they've been recategorized as conventional weapons. So we don't have the situation of the Cold War where nuclear weapons were considered to be the weapon of last resort, at least as far as U.S. weapons, nuclear weapons are concerned. They are now, they have been recategorized by the U.S. Senate and can be used in the conventional war theater. It's a very, very dangerous crossroads at which we are.
I have one final important question. We are not looking at China as influencing the outcome of any conflict we have with Iran, at least economically influencing it. Russia, India, Brazil, and other countries in the world that would support economically sanctions, not against Iran, but against any of those countries that go against it. And at some point, could we see China, in effect, trying to channel the world currency, the reserve, the dollar, over to a mixed currency, in which case it could have enormous influence upon what would happen to the value of our dollars?
I've just returned from a trip to China, and what I was struck is that the mandarins of the state, the scholars, because I met people in the Academy of Social Sciences and people at a pretty senior level, they are all very pro-U.S. They are pro-U.S. They don't want to even acknowledge the fact that their country is being threatened militarily. The U.S. financial establishment is well entrenched in China in terms of their ability to even in the credit market, in banking. That was signed in 2001, just in the wake of 9/11. It was a bilateral agreement between the Bush administration and the Chinese government pertaining to China's accession to the World Trade Organization. But it said that Western banks could integrate the Chinese banking system and go right down to the retail level of renminbi, in other words, local currency. And I mean, Goldman Sachs is well established in Shanghai, and we're not. Unfortunately, these countries, which constitute, in some regards, a countervailing power, I'm talking about Russia and China. They are also, they don't constitute an alternative. I mean, as far as, in relation to what we are living in the West, the Chinese people are impoverished. When I went to China, they said to me, we have 250 million migrant workers, okay? 250 million migrant workers, which is probably about a quarter of the labor force. And China remains to this day an industrial colony of the Western world.
I appreciate these insights, and I thank you for sharing them. My guest today, Professor Chuck Sadowski, thank you for being on, and we look forward to another conversation.
I'm delighted to be on the program.
And Professor Tremblay, thank you for all your good work. And again, the websites for both of these gentlemen, globalresearch.com, the book, The New World Order, and also the other website for Professor Tremblay is the
NewAmericanEmpire.com,
and the book is The Code for Global Ethics. I want to thank.
I should rectify, it's globalresearch.ca.
Oh, CA.
Yes.
All right.
Okay. Or the globalresearch.org.
All right. Thank you both very much.
I'm
Gary Noll. I'm happy to have had these guests on, Roderick Tremblay, and to get the insights that we have gives us perspectives we otherwise would not have, as well as from Professor Michelle, and we thank them both. I'm Gary Noll. Have a good evening.